WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. It's been a remarkable day. Israel and the PLO have agreed to recognize each other and work toward peace. The first stage is limited autonomy for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and Jericho. The agreement was worked out in secret with the help of Norway. Even the Palestine National Council, the Palestinian parliament in exile, was kept in the dark. My guest Nasir Arouri is a member of the council. Arouri is a Palestinian-American. He's written several books on the Arab-Israeli conflict and is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Arouri is also a former board member of two human rights groups, Amnesty International and Middle East Watch. Two documents were signed today. One is the Declaration of Principles, moving the occupied territories toward limited self-rule. The other is the exchange of letters granting mutual recognition between Israel and the PLO. Arouri says it's too soon to tell what real impact these documents will have on the future.
My skepticism emanates from the feeling that agreements, that both agreements, seem to be predicated on the assumption that the wrongs that were done here and really produced this conflict were wrongs perhaps that were done by the Palestinians and not to the Palestinians. And the reason I say this is because when you look at the two letters which Rabin wrote to Arafat and Arafat wrote to Rabin, you will see that Mr. Arafat's letter to Rabin consists of six paragraphs. And these six paragraphs contain apologies and commitments that he made. Commitments actually that had been made before in 1988 to renounce terrorism. So there is an assumption of responsibility here on the part of the Palestinians, at least in as much as Arafat speaks for a large sector of the Palestinians, that the Palestinians perhaps were engaged in terror when I think most Palestinians think that they were engaged in some form of a national over-resistance to an illegal occupation. And here I think that they do have a good deal of support from the international community. And then when you look at Mr. Rabin's letter to Mr. Arafat, first of all, he does not really say, "Dear Mr. Arafat." He starts it by addressing him without using the dear. And then he says, "In response to your letter of such and such date, and then in light of your commitments, my government has decided to recognize the PLO. It is not a recognition of the Palestinian people. It's recognition of the PLO. And it's a recognition of the PLO for the purpose of negotiating peace with Israel along the lines of what he calls the Middle East peace process. Also, I should say here that the other document, which is the Declaration of Principles, is a document for a very limited self-rule, for a very limited number of Palestinians on a very limited geographic space in Palestine. And this agreement, I think, will be judged by what happens during the second phase, and that is the final second phase of trying to deal with the difficult issues of Jerusalem settlements, refugees, land and water.
Now, you're on the Palestine National Council, the PLO parliament in exile.
Yes.
Arafat decided not to bring the Declaration of Principles to the Palestine National Council until after it was signed.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what your reaction to that is. Do you feel shut out?
Well, of course I do, and I don't think that I'm really the only one who feels shut out. I think that this probably applies to a good number of people who are on the executive, who were kept away from this, even including the negotiators, including the chairman of the negotiating team. I'm struck by the fact that Mr. Rabin had to sign in a hurry and go back so he can deal with his parliament, but I don't really see a similar concern on the part of Mr. Arafat. So I would say that he's not really paying enough attention to the legislative process and to the consultative process.
One PLO official said, it hurts, you know, this agreement, it hurts, but we had to break the deadlock. We had to start somewhere. Do you agree with that perception, even though, as a member of the council, you feel shut out?
Well, actually, you have to start somewhere, and I think that they did start somewhere. That's why I would say that probably most Palestinians nowadays, I think that it would be safe to say that a majority is hopeful, despite all the difficulties with this agreement. I think that they remain hopeful that perhaps it would lead to something else, even though it's a very limited sort of self-government in Jericho and Gaza. I think what's missing, however, from it is a real timetable and an agenda that would connect the two. I mean, other than saying that there will be a second phase, there's really no obligation on the part of Israel to proceed towards a final outcome that is shared by both. In other words, there really is no common vision here, unlike the process in South Africa.
My guest is Nasir Arouri. He's a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. He's also a member of the Palestine National Council, the Palestinian Parliament in Exile. He's the author of several books on the Arab-Israeli conflict. His latest is called Occupation, Israel Over Palestine. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nasir Arouri. He serves on the Palestine National Council. He's also served on the board of Amnesty International and the board of the human rights group Middle East Watch. What does it mean to you personally to have the PLO recognize Israel and Israel recognize the PLO?
Well, I would like to say that perhaps had this been a real mutual recognition with parity and mutuality and equality, then I would say that this would probably fulfill my aspirations and that of a large sector of the Palestinian community, because I think that the Palestinians in the mid-1970s really gave up the idea of struggling for a unitary state in Palestine that would be a state for Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And they opted for two states coexisting side by side in Palestine. I'm afraid that the agreement that was concluded today, and the basis for which are these two documents that were concluded last week, are not really rooted in mutuality. But hopefully, they would lead toward that as they begin to discover a common necessity to end decades of warfare and perhaps realize that the only way they can share this land is through equality and mutual respect.
You don't think that this agreement is based on equality or full mutuality? What strikes you as being less than equal?
What's less than equal in it here is that when we look at the preamble of the Declaration of Principles, I think that what is really missing from it. What's missing from it are the important principles. For example, one of the clichés that are circulating around these days is that the devil is in the detail. And I would say that the devil is not really in the details, but it is in the principles. There is a very important principle here that's missing, and that is a recognition that the peace that is going to take place here would have to really be based on the notion that there's an occupation that's been going on for 26 years, a prolonged occupation, that this occupation has to come to an end, that the acquisition of territory by force is inadmissible, so says the UN Resolution 242. And if these principles were there in the preamble, I think I would have probably felt more comfortable. But these principles are really missing from it.
How did you find out about the secret Norway negotiations, and what was your reaction when you found out?
Actually, I found out about it from the press, like everybody else, even though I should say here that just a few days before the news was released, I was attending a UN conference on Palestine in Vienna, Austria. And I did meet with a number of Palestinians who came from Tunis, who I don't think were really keeping it a secret, but I felt that they did not have a clue. I also met with people who normally would expect them to know, I mean, such as the chairman of the negotiating team in Washington. They did not know about it. I really, like many other people, I came to know about it from the press.
Do you think it was worth keeping it a secret to have this outcome?
Well, I think that a certain degree of secrecy is necessary for the success of negotiations. But I think that the agreements to really be successful probably needed some consultative process. I'm not saying here that it should really be presented to the entire parliament in exile, not so by any means. But at least the input of certain people would have been important. To mention one thing is perhaps a small team of legal scholars, people who know international law, might have been consulted. After all, Israelis tend to be very rigorous about agreements. And I do know that the other side is not really that rigorous. I think that the Arab side is convinced that their cause is just and that perhaps justice will prevail. But in the real world, that is not the way things go, really. At least a legal, a legal scrutiny would have been necessary.
How does this agreement change your opinion of Arafat, and how do you think it changes his status among the Palestinian people?
Well, I think that it depends really on what sector of the Palestinian people. It seems to me that the mainstream is rejoicing today. There's no question about it. I think that they view the struggle recently in terms of how acceptable the cause and its symbols, such as Arafat, has become acceptable to the United States. And therefore, the mere fact that Arafat lands at Andrew Air Force and that he goes to the State Department and that he addresses the American people with every congressman attending and so on and so forth, I think that this is viewed by them as positive. But I would like to say here that you really cannot underestimate the fact that you have other sectors that are far from being impressed, and particularly those whose problems are not answered by the agreement. In particular, I would say that hundreds of thousands of refugees who live in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan. Secondly, you have also the Palestinians in Israel who are citizens of Israel, but their status is not really very equal with that of Jews. And then you also have certain elements in the Palestinian body politic that do not endorse the agreement. So it just depends really on which Palestinian.
What kind of infighting do you expect there will be now between Palestinian groups, for instance, between Hamas, the more militant Islamic fundamentalist group, and the PLO?
Well, I think that the possibility of an inter-Nisan sort of conflict, of an inner conflict between the Palestinians, is there, but I would not say that it is extremely high, possibility.
Why not? I mean, Hamas has said that they're going to fight this agreement.
Yes, I think that Hamas said that they will fight this agreement. Let's not forget here that the Palestinians in the occupied territories have suffered a great deal for 26 years under this prolonged occupation, which has really been very repressive. And for them, even though deliverance, independence, is not going to have to come about for some time to come and may not come about, I think that many of them really welcome the fact that there's going to be some sort of redeployment of Israeli armed forces, and that they will be able to at least experience a relative measure of freedom. This is one factor here to be considered. The other factor, I think, is going to depend on the ability and willingness of both parties to translate the ideas and principles in this agreement into concrete reality, one that is perhaps in synchronization with the minimum demands and aspirations of the Palestinian people. In other words, I think that if it is going to appear in the next few months that this process could ultimately lead to independence, then perhaps many of the skeptics and the Hamas people would be disarmed.
My guest is Nasir Arouri, a member of the Palestine National Council. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Nasir Arouri. He's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and a member of the Palestine National Council. What do you think the chances are of this agreement leading to a Palestinian state?
Well, as we look at the situation today, we have a string of statements from Rabin, and I recall him saying that in the early 1970s, and he hasn't changed his mind, to the effect that there will never be a Palestinian state. So independence, Palestinian state, is really against the, it is not on the Israeli agenda, and it is not on the American agenda. So there's a challenge, I think, to the Palestinians here, and I would surmise that many Palestinians are seeing it as a challenge to see about making independence not only something desirable but necessary.
Could you be satisfied with any solution that doesn't create a Palestinian state?
Well, I really don't want to take the position that a state, no matter what, has got to be the final outcome. I am more concerned, really, about the notion of equality for every human being in the region. I think that if this principle is there, I mean, if we are having an agreement that is going to advance the notion of equality and human dignity for all, irrespective of class and creed and so on, then I certainly would be satisfied with it. And the reason I'm saying that is because the international relations have become fluid. I think that they have changed so much, and will probably change in the aftermath of the Cold War, to the extent that borders may not become so necessary. There will be really emphasis on the free movement of goods and services and individuals, and that people will not be insisting on lines and borders as they do in the past. I mean, I envision perhaps a Jerusalem with boroughs like New York City, rather than the Israelis saying this is Israel's capital until eternity, which is something that Mr. Rabin said today, and the Palestinians are saying, well, East Jerusalem should be the capital of the state.
I wonder if you're worried about the difficulty of Palestinians and Israelis stopping hating each other. I mean, there's been so many years of really deep hatred. I mean, how do you stop that?
Well, I mean, this hatred is not really, I mean, this is not something that is inherent in anybody's character, I should hope. Because if we look at recent history, We find that Arabs and Jews have really made contributions together to Western civilization. I was interested to see, and I was actually impressed, I should say, by the fact that Mr. Clinton, in his address, referred to the commonality, and he did find some interesting common denominators, which I'm not used to hearing, really, from U.S. officials when they talk about the Palestine question. But he did refer to the time in medieval Spain when the two people were making tremendous contributions. So given that, I guess that with the disappearance of the cause for hatred and resentment, I think that should subside. I mean, the cause is very simple. And that is, the Palestinians lost their home to what became Israel, and their life had become really abnormal. I mean, they're either refugees or people living under occupation, or they were second-class citizens in Israel. So if the reasons for this grievance disappear, then the hatred should disappear.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Nasir Arouri is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and a member of the Palestine National Council.